It's Wednesday, August 6, 2008, and you're listening to episode 110 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 3 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Rob.
My name's Chad.
My name's Matt.
Just never know what Chad's going to do. This week he finally introduces himself.
I did last week, too.
All right, so let's explain who Rob and Matt are. Right now, well, we're recording kind of on a funny day. We're recording on Saturday.
Which is always a funny day.
Yeah, it's normally we do it on a Monday or Tuesday, but because of that, I don't think Chris even knows we're recording. We just slipped that in under the radar. And we don't know where the heck John is right now, but two gentlemen here, Rob and Matt, which are two of the hosts off of the Bear Swarm podcast out of Springfield, Missouri, which is about 3 hours away from St. Louis, give or take a little bit, depending on how you drive. They have been kind enough to come up here for the weekend, and they're visiting us and some other people, and we wanted to get them in on a show. So here they are. You guys want to tell us a little bit about your show and about yourselves? And
why don't you go first, Rob?
God damn it.
Our show is pretty much Fear the Boot with swearing.
Cool.
Yeah. We were very concerned when we first started that people were just going to be like, oh, they're just copying Fear the Boot. But really, it's just that we're 3 to 6 people sitting around a table talking about gaming and not really with much like standardized format. It's just us being us.
Well, our format, it's personality driven. It's a bunch of guys showing up having a good time behind the mics. So if you've got personality, you can do the format. And by no stretch of the imagination is this a format we invented. It's not like we have specific...
No one had personality before us.
Well,
that we brought it.
Not in the gaming industry.
No, of course not.
There might have been people out there somewhere that did. But.
Well, that was the concern in the gaming industry. The personality, like as far as podcasts goes, clearly you guys.
That's right.
I mean, it's not people who cut lawns or do laundry.
No.
Right, exactly. It's interesting having you guys up here because we were talking yesterday about the possibility of getting all the Missouri gaming podcasters together to do some kind of a convention or to at least make a mass attendance at a convention here in Missouri. And it was interesting because if you work out the number of podcasters that are located either in or very close to the state of Missouri, it's like the bulk of gaming podcasting.
Yeah. Gaming podcasting is focused in the Midwest because really there's not much else to do here.
Well, you won't need to get them together anymore because you have all the important ones here right now.
That's right.
Fair enough. So,
except for Ross Payton of RPPR, but I know him, so it's kind of it's a personal thing.
So wait, you're slipping in a plug on your own plug. Excellent.
I can admire that.
Yes.
Oh, I've got like 8 more things I'm going to plug. Metagames Unlimited, located on 3309 East Sunshine, Springfield, Missouri.
Now, you guys are actually sponsored. I think that's what you're slipping in there. You guys are actually sponsored by a gaming shop. Am I correct? It's Metagame is the name of it down in Springfield.
Yep.
They give them beer and liquor and women.
Oh, I wish. No, they give us, you know, free internet connection. Let us record there.
That's cool.
There.
Yeah.
We get our own private little booth.
Nothing like beer bitches and 802.11b.
Yes.
Alrighty, Gen Con coming up here, I guess, by the time this show drops. We're just over a week away. So if you're going, we'll hopefully see you there. If you're not going, haha. But I wanted to give you guys a quick rundown of the itinerary we're going to have there. Just as in our previous year.
Drinking, sleeping, eating.
That's pretty much it. But we are going to sprinkle a few specific appearances in there.
Does this involve drinking?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I fall over it.
All righty. First off, so if you want to catch up with us, here's the places we know for a fact we are going to be outside of whatever bars Chad is picking. But these are the places we know we're going to be. First off, on Thursday from 2 to 5 p.m., we are going to be doing a hands-on workshop about podcasting where we'll be having people come in. You actually sit down. We will on the spot record a podcast, edit it, publish it, walk through that whole procedure. So if that interests you, be sure to sign up. I believe of all of our events, this is the only one that, as far as I know, has a cover price.
We have to come to sober?
Well, no, not really. I mean, it would be authentic if we were. It's like bowling. I can't bowl while I'm sober, and I can't podcast. So,
true.
Thursday night, then, we are going to be getting together for a Fear the Boot social event. I will post that link again in the show notes. If you are coming, be sure to check that out for the details, and that's going to be out about town. And we definitely hope a lot of people come to that. Saturday at 3 p.m., we are going to be doing a live recording of Fear the Boot. So if you are interested in seeing how an episode goes down, or if you want to jump in on the mics and say something in the middle of the episode, we are going to be doing a live recording of Fear the Boot Saturday at 3 p.m.
So I should show up to that.
And of course, all this, I suppose, is subject to change based on whatever's going on. So be sure to check your program itinerary. Second to last thing, on Saturday at 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., there's going to be a media meet and greet where it's going to be folks from podcasts and probably some other media as well that you can come by and say hi to. So won't be just us there. Come by and say hi. After that, I think there's going to be a gaming thing where we're going to do some games with people there. And then our last thing is on Sunday at 1 p.m., we'll be doing a panel on the future of media. So
That will not have many people.
No, nothing at a con on Sunday ever does.
Yeah.
But if you can come by and show love to us there at the last hurrah, then we'd appreciate it. I will post a link to the general itinerary for all the podcasting stuff that's going to be at Gen Con this year, and our stuff will be in there. So once again, if you're coming, I look forward to seeing you guys there.
We don't get to go to Gen Con.
That's sad.
I know. You guys need a better sponsor. They can't send you to Gen Con, the most important gaming convention, the largest gaming convention in the world every year. What better place to pimp their store and their products than a Gen Con?
Well, they're having a bunch of their employees go out there. And
I see how it is.
So you guys don't count.
Yeah. Wow.
Now, do they
that go, is cold shit.
The people that... the people that
wrong cast.
So, Bear Swarm. Where does the name come from? That's actually you guys before I came back into the group, huh?
Yeah, we explained it on our show once, but we'll explain it again here. It's kind of like an inside joke almost. We were discussing how much, like in D&D, first level adventurers, swarms absolutely just dominate you because if you're not prepared for them, you just get boned. There's no good way to deal with a swarm. And we were just joking around about, you know, what if you made a swarm out of something, you know, more menacing? And we decided that the most frightening thing in existence for any level adventurer would be a giant swarm of bears just like rolling over hillsides towards you. I mean, a bear pretty much sucks.
Yeah.
But if it's a massive writhing swarm, what can you do?
Well, you know, if there's a swarm right around me, I'd actually be more afraid of horses. I was in Jamaica.
No, I'd be afraid of bears.
Oh, have you ever been in the middle of a horse swarm?
Have you been in the middle of a bear swarm?
I have, actually.
Oh, okay.
There's a petting zoo where for a quarter they'll release a bear swarm on you. You slather yourself up with like berries and trout, and then they set loose like dozens of bears.
That sounds like an exceedingly kinky night.
It is. If you're into bears, this is the place to go.
Wait, what kind of bears are we talking about?
I don't know anymore. But I was in Jamaica a few years ago, and they took us on a horseback tour of a sugar refinery, or sugar plantation, rather, that had been in use back in like the height of the Caribbean age of 1600s.
Caribbean age.
I just made that up on the spot. We'll be backloading that into history.
Flying boats and magical palaces. The Caribbean
back
age.
Before Atlantis sunk into the ocean.
When you had orchestras of steel drums, it was the height of culture in the world.
This is like back in the 1600s when the trade around the Caribbean was at its height. And anyways, after that, they took all the horses out to the ocean. You could kind of ride the horses while they're swimming in the ocean, which sounds really cool. Until you're in the middle of a big mass of thrashing horses, and that becomes very, very scary. And I came very close to tragedy because one of the horses almost hit me.
Because you were like holding an ice cream cone and you totally dropped the ice cream.
In the ocean. And I dove for it and the stingray dove for it. And then
very close to tragedy, like you said.
I don't know, maybe it's just me, but when somebody would be like, let's ride a bunch of horses into the ocean, I'd be like, hell no, I'm out. Well, I want no part in horses in water.
How this ends is one of the horses rears up, comes down full force. I mean, the full weight of a horse, whatever a horse weighs. I know it's a lot. I mean, it's at least 20, 30 pounds. Comes down and its front leg, its hoof, slams down and just barely skims the skin of my ribcage. If that thing had been just 1 inch off from that location, he probably would have shattered multiple ribs.
He would have kicked you back home. You would have launched.
Oh, no, he would have stopped me into the ocean. I don't know. I probably obviously could not swim with a bunch of broken ribs, so that would have been the end of me. And the water was really choppy, too. So.
Oh, and you had that ice cream cone.
And there was the ice cream cone that me, the horse, the stingray, and Steve Irwin were all diving for. And
ooh, too soon.
All righty. We were going to do GM profile. Since John's not here and we didn't tell Chris about the recording, do you want me to go? Do you want these guys to go? Who should we do for our GM?
I want these two guys to go because You're not going anywhere.
Okay. No, so. Probably. Well, I'm going to Gen Con. But yes. You know, maybe we'll do my gamer profile, my GM profile at Gen Con.
Maybe. And these guys are just sitting here in awe of Fear the Boot right now. Right. They're not really talking.
Our brilliant hair. And
Yes.
So
can I get up off the ground now?
Yeah.
Yes. Off your knees.
So how do you guys GM? We talked last show. We explained how Chad GMs in the coming shows. We're going to probably hit John next before he goes off to college again.
And I have to say real quick, just to butt in, is that a lot of people said some really nice things about my GMing style.
I didn't.
There were a couple who kind of downed on it. Or they were like, well, that's not my style. But there were a lot of people who were like, oh, my God, that's a really interesting style. And one guy even said that when I was talking about how I GM, it brought him back into gaming. He like wants to GM because that's
all. Really?
I'm as amazed as you are, believe me. But he's like, I want to get back into GMing because of your story. And I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool.
Well, that's pretty cool. Yeah. We just got to put this stuff out there and assume it's not really impacting anyone, all ego jokes aside. And so
I'm seriously surprised that anyone other than our family members listen to this.
Yeah.
They do. So
surprised that anybody from Springfield's willing to drive 3.5 hours just to hang out with you guys.
That's why we always find it funny.
I thought we were paying you guys for this. No.
Yes. I'll give you the address to send the check to.
Excellent.
That's why I always find it funny when people think we're arrogant. It's like, no, that's all humor. We actually have very little esteem for what we do. So, all right. Anyway, you guys, GMing style, which one of you suckers wants to go first?
Sounds like Matt's going first.
All right.
Thanks for throwing that to me, Rob. Try it before I could direct it to you.
So, yeah. Matt, how do you GM? Do you GM? Because I think you were saying earlier that you really don't GM very much.
I haven't GM'd a lot recently. I recently started running a 4E game. Before that, I used to GM a lot. I don't have a good style, would be a good way to say it.
Wow.
I usually come up with an idea that I want to put them through and start working through.
By idea, you mean dungeon?
Yeah. Oh, not necessarily a dungeon, but I'm up until, Fear the Con, I had never played anything other than Dungeons & Dragons. So that tells you where I'm coming from. I come up with, okay, I want to do this and start looking for stuff for the encounters, that kind of thing, and start working up the stuff. And then I got about 20 hours of work I need to put in. I usually put about 3 or 4 in, have some stuff bookmarked as I run in, don't have everything printed out, anything thought up to the level I would like it. So I kind of do a little bit like Chad and wing it, but I should prepare more than I do. I will say that.
Now, which one of you guys does the Visio document for...
That would be me.
Okay, this is the definitely want to get to that in a second. So I'm sorry, continue, Matt. I was trying to remember if that was you or not.
No. I mean, I'll do maps up sometimes, that sort of thing. But I don't know. It's coming from D&D. There were a lot of dungeon crawls early on, and started to get away from that a little more story. But I like to let the characters drive the stuff, but I don't usually get enough backstory from my characters to actually let their character's personality drive it. It's usually, this is the character I brought to run in a dungeon crawl, so the game ends up being a dungeon crawl with as much role-playing as I can push in.
What about you, Rob?
I kind of have a style similar to Chad's, except I do a lot of prep work before I start running a game. I sit down and write up, locations and people, and I basically create a big sandbox and don't write any story, but I'll have an idea for what I want to do. And I just sit down and let the players start to play around in the world, and then I develop the story as I go. Cater to what they want and develop it what I want to see, but what the players are interested in. I like you brought up, I do some stuff like a lot of mapping stuff, creating stuff in like Visio, building layouts and stuff
down to the wiring.
Yeah.
You had it down to the wall. So if your guys are going to cut a security camera, you know where those cords go.
Yes,
that's really cool. Now, actually,
I'm going to start with that's actually sounds really cool, but here's the thing that would worry me. Do you actually finish that?
Yeah.
Because for me, when I get that ambitious, what happens is nothing happens. And that would be my concern. If I was personally going to do that, I'd sit down wanting to create that kind of detail. And in the end, I'd get burnt out. I'd get busy. I'd get distracted. None of it would ever
Well, my big actually problem manifest. Is I actually sit down and do all this and get detailed blueprints and schematics for the entire security system of this building. And then the players just like, we go flip the fuses. So all my work is just completely
yeah,
and then you can't even say like, that's gonna blow the game. No, you just it's a lockbox and it's on this other floor, you can't do it. And they're like, no, see, I'm following your diagram here, and it's Joe's an electrician. He's like, yeah.
the only games I get that detailed in is Star Trek and Star Wars. And the reason I do in those games is because it's easy to do. You want to lay out of a ship, you go online.
Yeah.
And either there's one you can find for free posted on the web, or one you can probably order for a couple dollars. Well, they'll send you a packet of poster-sized diagrams that somebody did on their plotter work under the table. And, like, for example, when we were on Star Trek, I loved to put them in the same type of ship that the Reliant was, a two nacelle under the saucer-looking thing. And you can get a really nice diagram of the entire layout of that ship online. Mm-hmm. And I ordered one of those, it was like $8 or something like that. And they sent me a bunch of poster-sized layouts of it. So I can tell them, okay, you're in the bridge, and this is where it goes from there. Would I personally take the time to draw something like that? Would I like to? Yes. Would I ever actually complete it? Probably not.
Yeah.
I think the big thing is with me, I'm extremely obsessive compulsive. So if I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it like through 800%. I'm not just going to do enough that it'll get me through the game. I'll know more about the location than I'll ever need to know when I'm running my game.
So that's where I start out when I try. I'm like, okay, I want to do this and this and this. And I get, like I said, maybe 5-10% of it done. I'm like, I want to go do something else for a little while. And then 3 days later, the game session's there and
yeah,
I got to run with half the stuff I need.
I mean, to just give you insight into how my mind works, I have my bookshelf, my gaming shelf, ordered by ISBN number.
Oh my.
Wow.
Yeah. And it bothers me if it's out of order. Like, I start to lose my shit and start, start to lose my cool and start reordering everything.
Yeah.
I do tons and tons and tons and tons of prep work before I get to the table. And then once I'm actually playing, I set up my GM screen and I randomly roll dice and tell them what I already decided. I
mean, so basically you lie to your players.
Constantly.
I feel betrayed.
So do I.
I'll know who the NPC is and I'll know about them and I'll know where they're coming from and what their personality is. But as far as their stats, I have no idea.
Yeah.
I'm like, I do a lot of World of Darkness. So I'll be like, that's about 9 dice. He kicks your ass. Sorry.
That's the way it's written. What I do is I take a lot of the sample monsters that come with some of these books or whatever. And my guys in D&D, if I'm running D&D, they fight skeletons over and over and over again. They're just not skeletons.
They just have different names. Yeah.
Yeah, but the stats are all the same. And they don't care. They don't know. And I really don't care.
I feel they're virtued. I invent my own monsters because it keeps everybody guessing.
Yeah.
It also avoids the D&D panic button on all the monsters, which that's not so bad in recent editions, but in earlier editions, so many of the monsters had a easy off switch where if the players knew what they were fighting, it made the fight so much easier than it was supposed to be.
And in those classic sort of D&D games where it's like only the barest minimum of a plot, and you have a dungeon crawl and then you have monsters. I mean, why don't the players just invest in a monster manual?
And it's absolutely.
Rust monster. Oh, crap. I don't know what that
Everyone
is.
Flip to page 30 or whatever. Well, it'd be a short monster's manual, but ours at page 30. But
well, it's just like, you just, get out your wooden weapons and beat it with clubs. Like, okay.
You know, I've done stuff like that. I hate combat in games. Mm-hmm. So when I'm stuck, like, having to fight a monster in D&D, I'm like, under the table, I'm like, monster manual. Here's Regeneration 5, guys.
Oh, we don't even do it under the table. It's a great group-wide event that everyone's paging through the monster's manual trying to figure out what it is they're fighting.
I think we've only had one game master once, and this was like the teenage high school days with crappy characters and crappy games and crappy game masters, where it was Mike. He got pissed that we owned D&D books. You know, it's like he was trying to run this game and we own them and we were looking at them.
He had a thing where if we ever purchased the Ravenloft setting, he would not run it anymore.
Right.
Ever.
Well, because, again, crappy game master.
Right, I mean, Mike's GMing certainly came a long way from there.
Certainly.
So.
But back then it was the Tour of the Realms, so if we read ahead to where we were going, it would spoil the whole adventure. The whole adventure would be ruined.
I mean, God forbid you know how to stop Earthshaker.
Yeah, no kidding. We get Ayn Rand out and fight the communist gnomes.
We unleash the great capitalist halflings to fight the communist gnomes, and down comes that Red Scare that's been threatening our realm.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the nice things about how I run games, though, is because no player can look up what I'm doing.
Right.
Because, I'm not doing anything.
Yeah, it's all... That's why I like how I run, too. I mean, I don't know, my players generally figure my stuff out pretty early on. And then that's just an incentive to me because they never pull each other aside and say, whisper, whisper, whisper. And I'm like, I wonder what they're talking about. They look at me and they're like, I bet you're doing this. And I'm like, oh, no, I'm not. Now.
Yeah, I do the same thing. I'll play up an angle for so long and somebody will be like, I bet, you know, they'll just be talking at the mm-hmm. table. They think I'm like reading something that I don't have in front of me.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, I bet he's going to do this and this. I'm like, nope.
I've never done this to you, Chad, but I've had this with at least one GM in the past where I've taken the writing actions down. Mm-hmm. Like the GM will say, okay, you know, one example is we were sitting at a table with a bunch of guys and I knew that this is the type of GM that no matter what I do, I was not going to be allowed to win the situation.
Right.
So I said, okay, I want to declare an action. He's like, okay, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm not going to tell you. I'm just going to write on this piece of paper. And I wrote on a piece of paper and turned it upside down on the middle of the table, went on with the RP, said, okay, you know, eventually we talk to him, say this, we get up and leave. And I say, okay, now turn the paper over. And I had thrown a bomb under the table before I'd stood up and leave. Mm-hmm. But I knew that if I had told him that action, I said, I'm throwing a bomb under the table, one of them would have seen it or kicked it out of the way or wouldn't have gone off or who knows what. So
yeah,
I had
no matter what the roles, the rules, exactly, the plot, the guy.
Just they weren't supposed to die. So I was not going to be allowed to have that. So I had to basically force the GM to declare actions beyond what I had done in order to get what I felt was the fair result of my act.
It just goes back to what we talk about on our show every week, GM and player trust. I mean, if you can't sit down and just trust your GM to run a fair and, you know, fun game for you, then you're kind of defeating the purpose of playing a game.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, it's like the player, the GM has the plot. I'm about to slam on the table, Dan's looking at my
hand. I'm going to get you those big puffy mittens I've been talking about.
That's right. So the GM runs the plot, and then the players... I did it. Way. Yes, you I didn't even what? Mean to.
I'm not going to get you big puppy mittens. I'm going to buy two chinchillas and stuff your hand up each of their butts at the start of every podcast.
That sounds somehow enticing.
Well, I mean, at least if you got everyone to scratch your face, it feel really like, comfortable.
I mean, I've got chinchilla poo on my hands, but...
But that won't really upset you until you pull your hand back out.
True.
I would have went with a tack strip along the top of the table.
Mm-hmm.
I could do what they do like in South America where you put the broken glass along the edge of buildings to keep people from scaling them. It's really, really cruel, but that's what they do. They break glass and then they bind it like into a tar glue and then they put it in strips along the edge of buildings so people won't try to climb the buildings.
It's kind of like barbed wire.
Yeah, I guess. Or my dad's parents, so I guess my paternal grandparents used to own a restaurant and it had one of those like really high windows above the door. And people used to break in through that. So my dad, when he was a kid, put a bunch of nails through that and came back one day and he put it on a little wooden strip that was sitting up there, came back the next day and it was down on the ground and nothing was robbed. So somebody got a handful out of that. But anyway,
give me a hand.
So what was the point you were making before you started your
something about players and
manly drum bonding routine on the.
So no, it's like, you know, the GM creates the plot. The character, the players bring the characters that interact with that plot, and together they make the story of the game.
Yeah.
You know, what's going on.
Team effort, not a competition.
Exactly. And trust. I mean, see, like the example you gave with the paper and the bomb and the this and that, you didn't trust the GM.
Yeah,
GM didn't trust you.
Precisely.
And, you know, I'm not making a judgment call on either one of you, but that's not, to me, that's not a good game.
Oh, I agree. And I'm actually getting into a deeper topic here of GM fiat. I'm a big believer that the player should be allowed to have whatever they earn, period. Yeah. And I do that in my games. If a player does anything, no matter how much I didn't expect it or don't think they should get it, if they pulled it off, they get it. I will allow them to have anything. In fact, I did that at Fear of the Con. A handful of you that played in my game at Fear of the Con, there were some things they did in those games I did not expect, but they rolled the dice, and so I gave it to them, and we went with that.
Well, it's stuff like that, like as a GM, that's what entertains me in the game. The players pull off something I wasn't expecting.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then I have to roll with the punches for that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. 100% agree. That is, for me, at least half the enjoyment of GMing is watching what the players do. And if I give them no room to be creative or give them no reward for that creativity, then I am destroying part of what I enjoy in the game, even as a game master.
Yeah.
Some of the best sessions I've had have been that I'm expecting them to go investigate this thing over here and they go a completely different way about investigating it. And
some of the best games I played in, the GM's like, here's your plot. And we're like, that looks boring. We're going to go do this. And the GM's like, okay, this will be here and that'll do that. And it was a ton of fun because not only did I get to decide what the story being told was, but the GM got to, you know, invent stuff on the spot. Everybody had a really great time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I enjoy.
Yeah, I like it when things I don't expect to have. Like this Cyberpunk game I've been talking about and running with these guys. First game, I just kind of wanted to test the waters a little bit and see how they would react. And so They were in a diner and the diner got robbed. And I was kind of, there was some gunpoint time. There wasn't really getting robbed. It was like protection racket gang thing. And it wasn't too deep. I kind of expected those guys to whip out their guns and say some cool lines. And the other guys were like, you know, I'll be back. I'll get you. And, or, you know, something. I wasn't really knowing what to expect. Oh my God. It was this horrible gangland shootout. I mean, it was like something out of the 1930s Prohibition Wars, where you see these restaurants where a gang boss gets a hit out on him and the whole place is shot up. And it was
Valentine's Day Massacre.
Yeah. And it was just like, at the end of it, everyone was looking at each other like, well, that escalated rather quickly. That
we won. So
yeah, that got totally out of hand. And it was really neat. I was surprised. They were surprised. And
like we got one, we won really without any. Well, I think one of us got stunned or something.
You got shot,
shaken.
Yeah, and you kind of fell back over your chair table or something. But yeah, but you were up and going at it. Your vest took it all.
Yeah, I always like seeing what the players can come up with within the context of what I've established already.
Yes, very much so.
And I've noticed it really depends on what game you're actually playing. Mm-hmm. Certain games lend themselves way better to this kind of stuff than others. I've been getting into a lot of the indie games lately, and so much of it is the players have so much narrative control over the story.
Yeah.
You really have to let go. I mean, you can't dictate things because the rules let the players decide their actions.
Right.
So,
whereas something like D&D, if you were to have a player try and go somewhere else or fight other monsters that you weren't prepped for, if they're trying to fight like high-level casters in 3-5, it takes you like a half hour to roll up a high-level caster to fight. So either you have to learn to wing it and just kind of guesstimate stuff, or they wait a half hour for you to come up with whatever they're fighting.
Yeah.
Or you flip over to Ogre Mage and just add a whole bunch of levels to him.
Yes. So what do you guys do if you have a group and you want the players to really interact and you know, get behind the driver's seat, maybe not for the whole trip, but for good chunks of it? What do you do when your players aren't very active? And that's not to say that they aren't, you know, they're active people and they really get involved. But like the trouble I'm having with my current game is that I'm the only one at the table who really understands the brand of cyberpunk that I'm running. You know, the other guys either totally aren't into sci-fi, or their introduction to cyberpunk is Shadowrun, which is cyberpunk light.
I've read Walter John Williams.
I mean, you know, and you are interacting, but the other guys are like, they said, you know, we don't know what to do, we don't know where to go, we don't know how to interact with this situation, you know, what are the rules, what are the boundaries and stuff. And so they don't, it's a game where the players have to drive a bit, but they're not driving. What do you guys do?
Well, since I have so much material developed of like people and places, I usually just throw it out on the table and just let them start picking through it, finding interesting people they want to look into and interesting places to go and stuff like that. If not, I take a lot of time to sit down and actually just talk to my players about what does your character want to do? And then I'll start putting little hints towards their goals.
Yeah.
Like if somebody wants to get a yacht and start yachting, there's an estate sale coming up. They just hear a rumor of it, and that gets that character rolling somewhere. And then usually I try to get another character on something else that could be tied to, say, that estate sale.
Yeah.
So then those two characters start running together. And I kind of just lead them with enough carrot to get them to start moving, and then I sit back and start reading my non-existent notes.
Yeah.
So that's you actually for your last couple games. I think you've had characters come up with a list of goals they want to achieve that aren't necessarily, like you said, big goals. Getting a yacht isn't something that,
you know, that could be instructive. I don't know that I want to center a game around it, but it just to have players to force them to make sure they're thinking their characters through and make sure that they've adhered to any kind of a group structure you're trying to organize, to ask the players to each write down like three goals or 3 to 5 goals that their character has. And that would instantly help you to understand kind of what sort of carrot you can lead them with and make sure they're going to work together. So I think it'd be a little too predictable if you center the campaign. Yeah. You know, that's what your main campaign plot was.
Yeah, like
Bob says he wants a yacht, so this campaign's going to be
the entire plot is you working through every single player goal in order.
Right.
You
know, yeah.
That'd
exactly.
Be a little stale. Yeah, I kind of wish I had that going on with my current group. I think that would really help me. But nobody really gave me write ups or anything like that.
So, yeah, I really
you guys.
In the last couple of games, I asked my players to give me goals and their motivations for accomplishing the goals, and I kept harping on them. I mean, if you want a realistic character, your goals are multifaceted. You have multiple things in different directions you're going after. It's not all about revenging your parents' death.
Right.
You know, you have other things that could be minor in scale compared to your big goals, but you have tons of stuff that you want to accomplish in your lifetime. And then I get that list together, and as a GM, this is where I have a lot of fun, because I sit down and look over and go, okay, how can I connect this one to this character, to this character, to this character, so it doesn't seem like I'm just leading them plot point through everybody's motivation, but there's a story unfolding that's resolving organically everybody's desires.
Yeah. I think that's the stumbling block I'm running into now. I don't know what is motivating my players. I mean, I one or two of them have motives. One wants a kind of revenge, but it's pretty unattainable right now. And one of them is bored and is just looking for things to do. And he's kind of doing that already via the playing the game. And it's just like, I don't know how to motivate the characters, and the characters don't know enough about the world that I'm trying to portray to them to self-motivate. So I think that along with the curse that our game is having, where every other week something comes up and we're unable to play, that the players and the plot are kind of stalling out, and it's just like I need to figure out a way to kind of goose it to get everybody rolling again.
Well, that's one thing that I try to do if I have players who aren't experienced with the world that I have is start them off in a rather small area. Like you said, you know, you'd mentioned driving your players, whatever. So it's right. They got a small area to play with and have stuff happen around them that gives them ideas of what they can do.
Yeah.
I found a good thing to do if you're really stuck and you really just don't know what to do. Has something explode nearby the player. They'll involve themselves.
Gunshots and screams.
Yes.
From across the bar.
Yeah, that is one interesting thing about players, is that players never really know how to mind their own damn business.
Yes. So. You know what's funny is sometimes it's even from people playing the characters who do know how to mind their own business. Right. I wonder if that's just something about role-playing that you want to experience the world, or do you think it's maybe a GM thing where players just assume that's the GM trying to get them involved?
Yeah.
And
if
everything that happens has to have something to do with them, because otherwise it wouldn't happen.
Right.
And so I wonder if that's a big part of the issue, that the GM wouldn't have a shooting across the room unless it was plot important. So we have to go get involved.
It's like that quote. I always don't remember exactly what it is, but it's like if there's a gun on the mantle in the first act, somebody is getting shot by that gun in the third act. You know, it's. Because you, if any type of story you're telling, you only have a limited amount of time or length to tell the story, so you have to be an efficient storyteller. You can't throw in a whole lot of red herrings that will lead the players nowhere, because there's no more boring of a campaign than following all the clues, doing all the fights to get to the end of the road in the clearing in the woods where there is nothing, and there will never be anything, and there never was anything, and you're there for no reason.
But if you're Stephen King, you'll just say, it was about the journey.
Yeah.
The end point's not important. It's how you got there.
When I look at my style and how I like to tell stories and stuff, I look at that statement of, you know, it's about the journey and all that. I'm like, you know, philosophically, I really agree with that. But that doesn't make a good game.
No,
you want to pay off at the end. I'm sorry.
Exactly. I mean, does not make a good game. Does not make a good story in general. If the ending's not important, why did you write it?
Right.
Why don't you make it important?
If you're running a Monty Hall campaign, then you got to get the big sword, the big armor, and the death disintegration jewel. If you're running like a D&D dungeon crawl, you got to get the level. You got to kill the dragon. You got to get that level up. If you're running a story driven game, you know, you got to get to the end plot, the big reveal, the tension breaker, the big cliffhanger for the next campaign, whatever. And it's like, you have to have that to where it's just like all this tension. All right, who's running the next game?
Yeah.
You know, that's just awful.
Well, even then, I mean, how many great gaming stories would you get if every game ended with, well, we retire and start a farm?
Yeah.
I sell my mech and quit.
Yeah.
I'm living off the $10 million I got from the sale.
Yeah, exactly. D&D too. It's just like I have a $250,000 gold pieces of magical gear. I sell it, buy a little castle, start an inn where other adventurers start their adventures.
Okay, that could be kind of cool.
Actually, that would be a really neat game to play. It's just like you You are
an anthology of the stories that come through your inn.
You are the owner of that inn, and all the players are either the locals or your help. And what the game master does is he runs the behind the scenes stuff, like the cloaked figure in the back of the room that starts the adventure. Well, he comes in 2 hours before the adventurers get there, and he's like talking to you about, man, I got this cloak. I'm really going to mess with these guys. I'm all dark and mysterious, right?
The truth is, there is no princess or dragon. Yeah. It's just a hill the wind echoes over.
The one dude sleeping with my wife, I can't beat him up because he's a big 20th level adventurer. This gets him the hell out of town for the next 5 months. Oh my God, that would be a great game
to run.
Something
else has been kind of a neat campaign is to do an anthology that way, mm-hmm. where you play... Your main characters are the people working the bar, but when like an adventuring party comes in, either starts their adventure or ends their adventure, mm-hmm. for a one-shotter, you play their adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next game session or whatever, a different party comes through, and every game is tied through this one inn or whatever, but each game, you have no idea what it is you're playing, because the game master is going to be like, okay, two dwarves and an elf walk in, and here's your dwarves and an elf.
And you somehow, you tie... what's going on, like an anthology, you tie in what's going on
to the inn or
to the inn and to the players. Right. It affects them somehow. See, I would love to play in these sort of experimental high concept games, but my group is, aside from Dan, is very traditional. And even you, you're pretty traditional about how you want your normal games to go.
Right.
They're pretty traditional guys. Yes. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm the oddball.
It's same here. I want so bad to play in a giant, like, political intrigue sandbox game.
Yes.
And all of my players are like, dungeon, dungeon, combat, fight. And I'm like, intrigue, politics,
story, characters, development.
So I run political intrigue games. I sit behind the table and watch all the players do stuff and then announce my Machiavellian plot that I just thought up 5 minutes ago.
You know what you should do? You should like do this big build up to the dungeon crawl. And they're at the dungeon crawl, and then you do the entire dungeon beginning to end as like a 2 minute long description of a cutscene where you tell it and you kill the dragon, and then you guys are leaving the dungeon and carrying the dragon's head and your boatload of gold. What do you do? Go back to the bar? Yes!
Nixon and Spiro Agnew are both waiting for you there.
Politics.
Wow. What I thought was cool is in one of the new Vampire of the Requiem stuff, mm-hmm. Requiem for Rome, they had debate styles.
Yeah.
They introduced this whole debate mechanic and debate system. So it's like, it'd be great if I set it up like, all right, create your vampires, the characters, go out to this old monastery, start, you know, finding out what happened here. You go down to the first room of the dungeon, there's a podium. There's another vampire on the other side of the room, another podium.
If you're not a master debater, you're not getting past this.
Yes. See, I would love to play the new Vampire the Masquerade stuff, because I really did not like that sort of Anne Rice style,
they fixed it.
Pseudo-sexual, erotic, goth, whiny, emo vampire, but the more political, dark, you know, political sort of, maybe I
dark,
said political,
political
twice, political, dark
fail,
goth,
political
thing that the new one is. I'd really like to play in a game of that. That's definitely more my cup of tea as far as like a vampire game would go.
I'm currently running one.
Wow. Too bad you live 300 miles away.
Yeah. You could trek down. I used to actually game with people when I lived in Minnesota mm-hmm. that drove, I think, 4 hours to get to our game.
Wow.
But there's like 8 of them, so.
That's dedication.
I lived in Springfield for a year. I have no intention of ever going back.
Now, the worst dedication I've ever seen, I will say worst dedication I've ever seen, was I used to work at a company here in St. Louis, and one of the guys that worked there lived where you live in Springfield. And he would drive that to and from work every day.
My mom worked in an office where there was a woman who lived outside of Springfield, not even in a town, right? In this dirt, gravel road in a house in the middle of nowhere, and would drive, you know, 3.5-4 hours one way to work in downtown St. Louis and then drive back.
Yeah, I don't get it.
I don't
really
understand
do
either.
Not understand
because
it.
There's areas around St. Louis where you can live in the middle of nowhere. And it's only like 45 minutes away.
Yeah. So. Well, I mean, if you moved halfway back, you're still in farmland.
Yes.
Now you're only an hour and a half away. I don't get it. Anyway.
I understand it. My dad used to drive like 2 hours to get to work every day. But it was because for his profession, for what he did, the only places he could get a job that paid that well were 2 hours away from where his family and everybody he cared about lived.
Okay. Was he a third level fighter?
Yeah.
Excellent. The dungeons were all in St. Louis. what did your father do, just out of curiosity?
Your mom.
Excellent.
Brother! No, he's a machinist.
He machined my mom. Wait a minute. Never mind. Moving on.
Alrighty. In the last episode we recorded, not episode 100, but the one before that, we talked about revolting against the GM. Today, we're going to talk about the other side of that. Revolting
clean
against
GMs?
A player. Oh, no, this is gaming. I mean, let's... we have to give people a standard they can reach for. So.
Oh, wow. Dan at feartheboot.com. You're going to get some letters.
All right, but what we need to talk about here today is the opposite side of that, revolting against a single player. And I have to admit up front that just like our GM revolts thing, this is kind of a douche thing to do. So if you can work things out with someone, we'll start off with that same disclaimer. Know your people, blah, 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 social interaction, yeah. Blah, blah, blah. If you can talk to the person and deal with it, that is your best way out.
Man hug. It's yes. All about the man hug. Big pat on the back, big bear embrace.
Even if it's a gaming group of all women, man hug.
Man hug.
Yes, precisely.
Man hug solves everything. Pat each other on the ass, give each other a high five, and then it's back to gaming. Now, we assume that you can't do the man hug.
So, here's how to be a douche.
Yes.
Successfully. You have a player.
Now, this is from You Are a GM.
Or
are we doing...
Well, let's set up the situation, okay. then we'll get the specifics. But the situation here is you're in a gaming group. Might be mm-hmm. a player, might be the GM. And you've got one guy in the group who is absolutely screwing up the game. Unfocused, belligerent, not on topic, too high strung, won't take the game seriously. Who knows what it is? I mean, you come with a laundry list of things that this guy might be doing.
So you have Steve Urkel in your game.
Yes.
Excellent.
So you have Steve Urkel, Steve Irwin, and
a stingray.
And Steve Ray.
Two of your players really don't get along. One of them's kind of stinking.
But so
I was going to say Steve Buscemi.
I ran out of Steve. Like I'm up with Steve-O, so I gave up there.
It's Stingray.
I didn't put the Stingray there.
Who invited us?
I put him in the ocean.
Is he in a chair? Do you have a bucket? How is this even work? Dan, this I can't even
you
deal
can't
with
picture
this reality.
Little stingray just sitting there with his little head looking over the edge of the table, and his fins just kind of go down. It would be a nice cartoon thing. His fins would go down beyond the table. We have no idea what's beneath that. How he's sitting on a chair or
and
anything
like
that.
He curls a fin around to die and rolls.
Or how confusing might be to talk when his mouth's like on the middle underside of his body.
He's like,
but
come on, Jinswit, time to play. And then Steve Irwin's like, blah, blah, blah. That's all that ever comes from you.
So here's Steve ruining your game. And
Steve now? This analogy's so confusing. Is it Steve Urkel's ruining
Fine,
the game?
Phil.
The Stinger. Oh, yeah. I've been there.
So, Phil is ruining your game.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that? How do you get this guy? Once again, assuming you can't talk to the guy, how do you revolt against a single player?
Well, let's assume that the thing that's revolting about the player other than his BO is that his we'll do a Phil example. His plans are always outrageous. Phil just gets lucky, and then I really like Phil, so I always let his plans work anyway.
And just to be clear, we've never done this to Phil.
No, not much anyway. But Phil, this person named Phil, is always coming up with the most outrageous, crazy ideas that should never, ever work. And he's always doing, no matter how, I mean, you yell at him, like, it's so stupid! I can't take it! You know, basically, when it comes down to the planning stage, if you're the players, you just ignore him. And you're like, okay, that's nice, Phil. And you turn around and, you know, you kind of go with it anyway. So, I mean, other than ignoring him, what else can you do?
Well, okay, let's take some things off the table. You can't kill the game.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know. It depends. If it's bad enough and you just really need to unload this guy, then maybe you could use the same techniques for killing a GM and use those on a player of kill the game, delay the game, start up another game, and just find some way not to include this person. So maybe that's an option, but I'm presuming, well, let's presume here, you don't want to kill the game. So let's just take, because the GM's fine, the other players are fine, probably the game's fine, it's just this one guy's disrupting it. And if it was a bad game, how's he disrupting it anyway? So we'll presume you want to save the game. Not inviting the person step is a possibility, or finding someone which they can't come. Moving your game to a different day when you know that guy's busy.
Wow, that is a dick move.
That's a very... Hey, I'm not saying any of these are nice moves or that I recommend any of them.
The GM can't make it on the old day anymore. The only day he can run is when you can't make it. Sorry.
Wow.
I mean, I always found my technique to just be a douchebag to somebody I don't want in my game. Just to walk up to me and be like, you suck. I don't want you in my game ever again. And that's that.
Yeah.
And then usually everybody gets mad at me because I was really mean to somebody. And then,
oh, no.
So it's not a good tactic.
To someone.
But it gets rid of people.
Yeah.
The one time I had a player we wanted out of the game, we were in college and the end of the semester was coming up shortly for the summer. So we just kind of waited for the end of the semester to come. We ended up moving out of the dormitory into an apartment and we lost his phone number.
Wow. Whoops.
That's a little harder in the age of the internet, though, especially when at least all the people I associate with, we mostly communicate via email anyway.
True.
And people rarely move away from their email address. Mm-hmm. Except the boneheads that still try to use their ISP's email instead of going out and getting a Gmail account. And then every time they turn over their ISP, they have a new email address.
Oh, painful.
Yeah. If you're one of those people, go get a damn Gmail or Yahoo or Hotmail or something account. They're free, and it stops us from having to figure out how to contact you every time you change your ISP, which you'll say is never, but in truth is every 3 months. Carla's parents do the same thing to us. God bless them, but they're always changing their email address. What about silencing the person? That's maybe a harsh term, but what about
just saying, like with listen, a gun? Just shut up.
Everyone ignores them.
Well, that's
assuming
what I was saying,
assuming they can take any kind of a hint, and I have run into people who can't, but assuming they can take any kind of a hint, that people just kind of start hedging around.
The problem that we've had with Phil is that Phil comes up with a ludicrous plan, but the other guys don't come up with any kind of good plan. So what they end up doing is they basically take Phil's outrageous plan and redo the words of the plan so as not to violate any copyright and really end up doing his plan anyway.
Right.
Which sends Phil into a furious rage because A, he came up with this wonderful plan. B, he got totally ignored, called a loser, told to shut up.
And then they use his plan anyway.
And then they don't give him credit for it because they kind of changed one of the two insignificant parts about it. And then he's like, my plan! It's like, oh no, we used bunnies instead of ducks as the disguise. Like, ah! And he just goes berserk. And which causes him to create more outrageous plans. But I wouldn't really say that Phil's disruptive. I mean, personally, I think his ludicrous plans
are like a landmark of gaming to me.
Yes.
If I'm gaming with Phil, I expect them. I'd be disappointed if they're not there. It's like when I was in New York, I was very happy I had a crazy taxi cab driver. Because if I went to New York and didn't have a crazy taxi cab driver, I just would have felt cheated somehow.
Remember when we were talking about getting Phil into our gaming group with you, and you had heard the stories, but not really, you didn't really know Phil that well. And you're just like, well, I don't know. I kind of like a more serious game and I don't know about this Phil. And we're like, you don't understand. He's ludicrous and he's all the things you hate, but he makes the game fun. I can't imagine not gaming with him.
Right. And so, I agree. And I know I haven't met him. I agree. Phil's very hard to explain.
Yes.
In bullet points.
Yes.
So maybe he's a bad person to use as you're revolting against the player.
He is. And I don't know that we've ever run Phil out of a game. Steve Irwin and a Stingray are already at the table. So why not throw in Phil? It somehow makes sense.
So what are some ways that...
Well, we game in a gaming store. Yeah. So we get a rotation of people that I don't want in the game.
Yeah.
So some of the tactics I have used. If I'm comfortable killing the game, quote unquote, I'll be like, okay, I'm not feeling this. I'm going to run something else. Even if it's the exact same game, I'll just be like, but I only want 4 players. Sorry, you missed the cut.
Nice.
And that seems to work fairly well. The person keeps hounding you for a while and you're like, sorry, still playing this. Sorry, no more seats. Sorry, can't help you.
Two months later, you have an extra couple of players at the table.
Yeah.
Do you guys get spectators at your games?
No, we actually game in a separate room from the main area. We're actually isolated.
Every once in a while, we'll prop the door open to keep it cool, and we'll get somebody standing in the doorway watching. But it's not...
We always got spectators at our games. With my old group, we would run at a place called Local Fantasy Shop, which is an absolute horrid gaming store now, by the way. They would it was like open game. They didn't have private rooms. There's open tables. There's always three or four games going on at one time. And then we would just kind of go to the side and we would run our game. And they would be running the D&D dungeon crawl. And it would be like, I am playing Phytor and all that. And we would be running a game with story and people kind of act, not LARPing, not getting up, but, you know, acting out, talking in voice, being gregarious and stuff. Every time we played, man, people would start coming over and spectating. And then we'd kind of, hey, can we get in? Oh, we're full up. And, oh,
you know, thinking about it, before we moved to a private room, we did game out in the big open area. Mm-hmm. And there were a few times we'd have people come by and listen in and just stand around. But we are so engaged in what we're doing that we don't give people an opportunity to inject into our game. Yeah. They eventually just stand there for like an hour and a half and then drift off.
Say,
but there's been a couple times that we were set up between two big like wargaming tables.
Mm-hmm.
And we were playing, and next thing we know, we hear the wargamers like, man, that's cool. We look over, they completely stopped playing their game, and they were just watching us.
Yeah.
So
there were a few times we've had people since we've moved to the private room, like I said, with the door propped open, and they've watched, but I don't think it's ever been that long, the hour and a half. I think it's been they might watch 15, 20 minutes. I don't think for the most part they've interrupted us at all.
Yeah.
We
don't give them an opportunity to interrupt. We just keep rolling on and on.
If they do, they'll ask us, usually the question is, we'll stop to get a soda or whatever, and then we'll be like, so do you guys know of any games that are looking for players? I just moved into town. I'm looking for a game.
Or we'll get the same guy asking us the same question every friggin'
time. See, spectators, I think, are an easier breed to deal with, because with a spectator, if they're watching the game and their presence bothers me, I probably don't know who they are.
Yeah.
And therefore, politely asking them just to go is a lot easier than taking someone who's in the game.
Yeah.
I mean, see, even if it's somebody I knew and liked. I mean, let's say that, like, I was running a game and Chad just happened to stop by and was watching the game. I would have no.
I would sit down at the table and start playing.
Well, yeah, exactly.
You want me to or not.
That wouldn't bother me. First of all, even if you're a spectator, but secondly, I'd just throw you an NPC or a PC. And but even if none of that was a reason, your presence bothered me, and I still could just turn to you and say,
like, "Your damn beer."
Yeah, be like, Chad, you know, like you've always said, gaming's not a spectator sport. Why don't we get together tomorrow for some beers and?
Ah, the crushing weight of my own hypocrisy. Run. Now, what? See, for me, it's a twofold problem. One is that if you're in a public place, like a gaming store or something like that, you have external spectators. We never had anybody interjecting, you know, occasionally inquiring about whether they can play or not. We just told them no. But you have the spectators, and it always makes me uncomfortable, people watching my game. I've said gaming's not a spectator sport. I just don't like it. But you can't say anything. It's a public place. You're there in public. You have to deal with it.
Well, you can say something. You can stand up and be like, there's nothing to see here. Move along. Keep going. I don't want you here. But you have to be willing to be a jerk to do stuff like that.
Yeah.
I've done it.
Yeah. But the thing is, if it's like a private residence and there's a sister or a brother or a mother or, you know, friends or whatever, people coming in and going out, and then they start watching us, I'll draw them into the game. I'll start having the NPCs interact with them. Like, they're standing there, and then they just start treating it. And 9 times out of 10, they're like, oh, and they go running away. And God forbid if you actually get somebody who kind of jumps in and joins in, hell, get them down, get another chair, get them down the table.
Most of the time, we just ignore anybody who's watching us.
Yeah.
And just, you know, it's, we put one hand to the side of our face and just kind of look away and just focus on our table. And eventually they wander off.
The scheduling split. You know, this game's getting too big. So what we ought to do is we'll continue this game on the same day. We ought to start another game on a different night.
And then nobody shows up at that.
And then you allow one of them to die within a few weeks. Picking a game they don't like.
Yeah.
And this depends on the person, because there are some people who game anything. But if you know there's a game they just will not play in, then funny if that isn't your next campaign.
You know what you can do also is the hookup. Because you always know people out there who are looking for a game that you have absolutely no desire whatsoever to game with.
Hey, we know the Stingray is looking for a gaming group.
Yeah. Why don't you and Stingray hook up? And, you know, you try and do the hookup.
One of the other things, I have some players that I don't really... It's not that I don't want them in my game, but they don't bring anything to the table. They just kind of waste my space. So I just make, you know, the same requirements from everyone else. I'm like, I want a decent backstory. I need to know about your character. I need to know where you're coming from. And when they don't give me anything, I'm like, all right, well, I don't have anything in my game for you. You can sit there until you can think of something, but I'm not going to cater anything towards you until you bring something to
me. How many people do you have in your game?
currently.
Six? How many do we have?
Six is total. I think on average we're four or five.
Yeah.
Four or
five. At the moment we have five.
Five.
You, me, Pat, Dave, and Josh. Yeah. So at the moment it's five.
Hmm. I've been in groups as big as 14.
You got me be biggest I was ever in was 11.
Yeah.
And that was way the hell too big. I mean, way too big.
That was like assistant game masters and
yeah,
stuff.
We did. We had two game masters. The only way we could run the game. And we went,
and it didn't really get run.
It no. Was, it, yeah, you can't possibly run a group game for group that monolithic, megalithic even.
Yeah, I played in a game with 14 people, including the one GM. And I would show up on weekends, curl up on the couch, take a nap, get my experience, and go home. I mean, that was it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That I wonder if anybody's has played in a game with like, you know, 15 people in it at one time. Yeah, and the, and has actually done something and everybody else at the table
the
has
only person I cannot remember who this was, the only person I heard described to me something like that that sounded vaguely workable was very GM hands off, where it was more of a sandbox, super high RP kind of game where everyone kind of broke up into their own little groups and did stuff. The GM would just kind of bounce between them and every so often would resolve an action like, well, we search here, what do we find? And he'd answer that. And then, but the players were so self-sufficient in what they were doing that it, I don't know, to me, this violates what a traditional role-playing game is anyway. Yeah. I'm not saying it's bad or wrong, but
no, they're playing it wrong.
Well, we've had games like that where the game master hardly lifts a finger because everyone's role-playing. And that's great. Those are wonderful games, but I don't think that counts towards our question of, has anyone ever run a traditional style, heavily game master, hands-on game with
50-man dungeon crawl?
Yeah, exactly, with 10 or 15 people.
You know what kind of game that would work for really well is a LARP. And a LARP in like a big or a big area, a big hotel.
LARPs don't work well for LARPs.
But, I mean, you basically have, you know, 20 people, and they all know the general plot. You have a couple of GMs running around to resolve things and whatnot.
I assume that's how LARPs worked.
Yeah, just huge amounts of people. I think LARPs are kind of designed for the large crowd myself. So
I think it comes down to, like, there are certain games that would deal better with larger crowds than other ones. Any game that the players can actually have input on what their actions do, you can have more than, you know, the traditional six adventurers going through your dungeon.
Provided that their actions can't screw each other up.
Yeah.
Because then you have eight people, if they're trying to do stuff at the same time, they could be messing each other up. And
I don't know. I really can't speak to that because I've never been part of a large-scale LARP, nor have I ever, like, played in one or ran one. So
only small-scale?
Only small-scale, yeah. Only, you know, Gimp Mask, Assless Chaps.
Lone Wolf LARP.
Yeah, you know how people, like, cross their arms on their chest? That's invisible. I walked around like this, so.
The shocker,
The shocker.
Getting rid of players and douchebag way.
It was a LARP. They told me it was gaming.
I have too active of an imagination.
If you know someone who's a bigger douche than you are, sometimes that's another way to get rid of someone from the table.
Oh, make somebody else be the bad guy?
Exactly. Bring someone in who's happy to be the bad guy, or even maybe not happy to be the bad guy, but you know that person A and person B dislike each other so much they will not stay in the game together, and person B has a lot more staying power than person A does, and thus goes person A.
Or you can, in the end, just tolerate them. You know?
Yeah.
It's just okay, it's this ludicrous plan. I mean, it depends on what the annoyance is. I mean, if it's just ludicrous plans, take it with a grain of salt and laugh at it.
And I want to reiterate that we do not encourage being a douche. If you talk to the person, be straight with them. Don't.
Hey, like we said, it's all man hugs, high fives.
Right.
You know, you got to get that pat going. And
we're just trying to talk about the people that don't get the hint, that show up at your table every Sunday asking if you have a seat open, and you're constantly like, no. No, no, go away.
What do you do?
Just don't get it.
What do you do with the person who shows up to the wrong game? And what
shows
I mean
up to the wrong game.
Yes, and what I mean by that is you and say you have a group of five people. You and the four other guys are running some like Dogs in the Vineyard, a storytelling game, or a game with an oratory mechanic and something that is very story, very character driven. Combat, not so much. And then this guy shows up to the power leveling Monty Hall dungeon grind fest.
I give them nothing.
I kill their character. If you want to fight in my game, prepare to die.
Well, it's one of two things. One is I'll talk to the person. I guess really if this occurs, you've already gone horribly awry by allowing this person into the game with those expectations. But
what if that's the expectations they think
of every game?
They think that's what gaming is, yeah. And no matter how much you explain that to them.
I give them nothing until they get bored and leave. And that's worked for me many times. If I know somebody's there for the power gaming, the Monty Hall, and all there is dramatic scenes all throughout the game, they get very bored. And typically they'll have a few spasms where they'll try to just start attacking bartenders just to make action.
Yeah.
And when you do not reward them even on that, they eventually get frustrated and leave of their own accord.
Now, I think that...
And then you can feign the moral high ground by getting upset they quit your game.
Now that's Machiavellian.
Now, I think that's a good tactic just across the board. If there's somebody you don't want in your game, just start frustrating them until they leave.
Yeah, just don't just find out what they...
everything they do.
Yeah, why are they there? And then don't give them that.
Yeah.
But I think that with the Monty Hall person or whatever, it I think there's a difference. There's because I've had in every single one of my games, there's that guy who wants the combat and stuff. But he is doing the role playing. He is playing along. But every once in a while, as a game master, you just got to throw him the bone and let him kill somebody.
I think the difference is you've got someone there who likes certain things about gaming that may not line up with your likes, but they're not disruptive.
Right.
And I have no problem with that. I've had players like that as well, where they come and I know they want something a little different out of the game than what I'm running. And so I'll throw them some bones because they're good guys and I don't have a problem helping them have fun.
But I've been in the games where it's like, okay, you know, you're brave adventurers and you go to see the king and you walk into the throne room and the guy's like, I throw my sword at the king's head. What? And he's like always rolling dice. And we're like, the king's the good guy.
Yeah.
Ah, he's got a beard. I don't trust him. Ah, and it's just like, do you understand there's an army there? Do you understand that?
That's when suddenly the king shocks everyone. You roll a die behind your hand so the king catches the sword.
Or one thing I've used with like a very similar example is it was in a modern game. They killed the mayor of the town. Mm-hmm. So they were wanted by the police. And for the rest of the game, they couldn't do anything because as soon as they stepped out, there's a squad car.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
They left my game because, well, you won't let me leave my house.
But why'd you kill the mayor? He was the highest level guy in the town. What? my brain!
I think one thing you need to pay attention to when you're deciding whether or not to get rid of a player is if the player annoys you a little bit, regardless of what it is, but do the other players enjoy having them around and do they get more out of having that player there? If that's the case, you might just need to bite the bullet and, you know, deal with having that player annoy you as the GM a little bit if the rest of the players don't like him. If it's like the player I had where all of the other players were plotting how to kill the character and get them out of the game, then you probably need to get rid of the player sooner. Because, well, you have other players who aren't having fun at the table.
Right, right.
Way to be sensible.
Sorry. Well, it's not our show, so I figured we could be sensible.
Alrighty, then I guess gonna go ahead and wrap it up for this episode. So thank you guys for tuning in and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2008, fully owned by its hosts. Our theme song was written and performed by Tim White. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.